these two parties, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, have had their chance. And they've blown it.
Oh, come, nobody ever reads manifestos during the election, Sean, you know that.
They've taken our policies.
Such a collection of chancers and charlatans.
It can't be like, here, vote for me, bye.
Yeah, I should be the Taoiseach, that whole.
It's Wednesday, February the 10th, and you're very welcome to the Inside Politics podcast from the Irish Times. I'm Hugh Linehan. Do not adjust your receiving devices, because through the magic of podcasting, we wanted to take you back in time to the last time that we used that opening tune, which was on February the 11th, 2020, with our very last Election Daily podcast. It's 1 year ago this week since voters went to the polls to elect the members of the 33rd Dáil. The result of that election, which saw Sinn Féin emerge as the most popular party, was widely seen as an unprecedented shock to the traditional Irish 2.5 party system. And yet within a few weeks, attention would turn completely away from all of that and onto the global COVID-19 pandemic which struck the country. Today, though, we do want to take a look back at that election result and reflect on what it seemed to mean at the time, and also how we should understand it now. What lessons, if any, have the parties learned from it, and how has that influenced their strategies since? To discuss this, I am joined by UCC political scientist Theresa Reedy, who is also one of the co-editors of How Ireland Voted, the regular Bible on this subject, which I'm told will be imminently in our bookshops. Also by Pat Leahy and Jennifer Bray from our political staff. You're all very welcome. Pat, if I can go to you first, the Irish Times is very fond of anniversaries. We mark them all the time. In fact, we're in the middle of a whole bloody decade of them at the moment. And sometimes I'm not quite so sure of the value of those. But in this, it does seem valuable because of everything that's happened in between now and 12 months ago. I think we've kind of forgotten some of the really significant things that happened in February 2020.
Well, I'm not sure we've forgotten them, Hugh, but I suppose, you know, given the tumultuous year that we've had, it's no harm in reminding us of them. And for those of us that watch the kind of daily practice of politics and, you know, follow the ups and downs of changing policies, we can sometimes forget how large elections loom in the minds of politicians. So we tend to think about elections just before they happen. And obviously, we're very intensively engaged in covering them when they're on and their fallout afterwards. But politicians think of elections in a different way than we do. They think about them all the time, and everything that they do in between elections has one eye on an election. So it's no harm to remind ourselves of that, I suppose. I mean, clearly last year, and we'll come on to, I guess, talk about this in more detail, but I think it's important when looking at last year's election not to consider it as a solitary, unconnected event. I think it was the third in a series of profound change elections that brought about profound change to our politics and our political system, beginning in 2011, continuing in 2016, and reaching perhaps a culmination, or perhaps just one in another in a continuing series, or a series that is to be continued in change elections. But you can't make sense, I think, of what happened during the 2020 election and subsequently without one eye on what happened beforehand. The traditional politics of this country, which changed, you know, very little by comparison to other Western European democracies between the years of, you know, the 1920s or the 1930s and the 1980s and 1990s, has changed massively in terms of, you know, how the political landscape is ordered in the last 15 or 20 years. And the benchmarks of change during that period were the general elections. They showed us the changes that were taking place. They gave expression to those political changes. And last year, I think, was obviously the most recent in that succession of big changes.
Theresa, what do you think of that analysis, that this is the third in a kind of a three-act play of dramatic change in Irish politics? And I'm trying to stay away from crystal ball gazing, but, you know, Is that an ongoing process? Is it going to end up being a 4-election play or a 5-election play? Because one of the things that strikes me about the results we saw last February was that I'm sure for at least some of the players involved, particularly Sinn Féin perhaps, they saw it as a staging post rather than an endpoint.
I mean, I think the best way of thinking about politics is that it's a dynamic process anyway. So the question, or I suppose the case, is that ours has been a lot more dynamic recently than it had been for, you know, the preceding decades. I think one of the really interesting things to look at over the last couple of elections, and I do agree entirely with Pat that this is a process, is that it's the connections that voters are making with political parties. In the past, voters actually made enduring connections to political parties, and that was the stability that actually generated the party system. So people were attached to political parties and they voted for them over long periods of time. What we've seen since 2011 is that the connections that voters are making with political parties are much more transient, and they're much more subject to change, and there is a very strong penalty for governing. So political parties that promise a great deal, suggest a new dawn, when they get into power, the realities of governing are indeed much more complex, and they often lose the, you know, fleeting voters that they had gained at the preceding election. So voting has become, you know, a much more transitory process than it was in the past. And that kind of enduring connection that people make with political parties just isn't there anymore. And that's why I think this isn't an end point. There's no reason to believe that what happened in 2020 was voters forming a more permanent or enduring connection with the political parties they chose in 2020 rather than in 2016 or in 2011. And this is a phenomenon across the world, that kind of deep and enduring connection, that social bases that underpinned politics in so many countries are eroding. And that's why we're seeing so much fragmentation in politics and so much change from one election to the next election. If we look at 2016 and 2020, and these were elections that actually took pace against the backdrop of relatively stable economic activity. So they shouldn't have been, in the kind of typical sense of the word, transformative elections, the kinds of volatility and changing from one party to another has to be rooted in something more than just the regular process of day-to-day politics at a time of positive economic development. So we're seeing something different happening, which is that, you know, this connection to political parties is much more transitory, and therefore it's much more volatile. And we've seen that flow out from the kind of 2011 election, which kicked off this it accelerated this process in a very significant way. And I think we'll see the consequences of that flowing for several more elections to come. There's no reason to believe that this is a new stable point in the system.
No, I mean, stability is definitely not going to be the paramount factor, Jen. If you're looking at those two factors there, which Teresa describes, one being that voters are much more fickle, I suppose, much more likely to bounce from one party to another between one election and another. And the other one is that there's a penalty attached to governing, and that you're likely to do better at the next election if you haven't been in power. You put those two things together, and that, call it instability, call it greater flexibility, whatever you care to call it, it's a very different kind of a dynamic, isn't it?
It is a very different dynamic. And I think that the, as pointed out by both Pat and Teresa, the dynamic fundamentally shifted after 2011 and after the recession and after Fianna Fáil were booted out. And I think Fine Gael were given that chance to come in and address some of the issues, some of the many issues that people had. And to a certain degree, obviously, they got back into 2016. And, well, we know what happened last year. And I think people probably were looking at the sort of dominance of those two parties, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, and the two-party system that we'd had before, maybe thinking that that wasn't for them anymore. Or even a 2.5 party system of one party with maybe a smaller party, Labour or so on. So we saw the change, the shift away from the dependence on one or the other. And I think in that intervening period, Sinn Féin obviously spent those years building up around the country, selecting their candidates, etc., and really coming into their own. So looking back, it was no great surprise, I think, that Sinn Féin did so well. I think maybe it was the speed of it probably that took people by surprise. I suppose the other thing that has changed since 2011, 2016, and then last year is, I think, the advent of social media in politics. And it has played a role in making it more volatile, I think. I think things play out so much quicker. There's an extra heat to it. You know, you would previously have had maybe a political controversy that would have played out over a week or two. They play out now over 24-hour periods. And I think politicians are perhaps too attuned to what's happening on social media. And some of them seem to believe that, you know, you have to react on the basis of what's happening there rather than maybe what the better reaction might be long term. So I think there's a couple of things at play there. And, you know, if you look back to last year, what were the things that really mattered to people? You know, what is it that captured the imagination when it came to Sinn Féin in that campaign? And obviously, we know it were the issues. They were the issues of housing and health, but there were other issues too. You know, you remember the rise in the pension age. I think that became quite a big issue for people. And Sinn Féin took those issues and made them sort of their campaign from a very, very early stage. And Fine Gael, on the other hand, I suppose instead of really addressing those major, because we're talking about people who can't, you know, get a home, you know, we're talking about a homeless crisis. And now we know how important it is to have, we've always known how important, but now we really know how important it is to have a fully, properly funded, properly resourced health service. But instead of kind of addressing those issues and maybe saying, maybe holding their hands up and saying what they would do differently, the Fine Gael campaign focused on Brexit. And they focused on the economy. And that just didn't capture people's minds. Now, obviously, we're in a different position now in terms of the economy. Maybe people would think differently now. Maybe people will put a bigger stock, more importance on the economy. But at the time, I think people were fed up of hearing that we were only halfway through Brexit and that we had Team A. You don't want to let Team B in. You don't want to put Sinn Féin in because of stuff in the past. People weren't really connecting with that message at all. And afterwards, I think Fine Gael had a review of the election. They did find that they were detached, you know, detached from what people were, what mattered to people, to be honest. So I think, you know, like not to underestimate the actual issues that come up in a general election campaign beyond kind of just the wider sort of political affiliations that people generally might have.
Pat, we do know that campaigns matter, but is it the case, given the landscape which Theresa and Jen are talking about there, that campaigns matter more than they used to, that there's greater volatility in the electorate, there's more opportunity to get a real surge just over the course of the 3 or 4 weeks of a campaign? Because that certainly looks to me like one of the lessons from last year.
Campaigns have always mattered. I think one of the corollaries of the picture that we've been painting and that Theresa described earlier is that campaigns matter more than they used to, simply because if there are fewer voters who are historically, naturally and unalterably aligned with particular parties, and there are, in the way that we used to think of Fianna Fáil households and Fine Gael households, now that is much less the case when, you know, looking at electorate, and that's the way politicians will tend to look at it. But if there are fewer Fianna Fáil households or fewer members of the Fianna Fáil households that can be guaranteed to vote for Fianna Fáil, that means that there are more votes up for grabs in the campaign and the period that and the period that goes before it. So I think we've seen in the last number of elections how there has tended to be in those three elections, and even to some degree before that, how there has tended to be a move in one direction during the campaign. And that happened to Sinn Féin's benefit, certainly in last year's election. But let's not forget that if that caught us there, the extent of that caught us who were covering the campaign by surprise, it also caught Sinn Féin by surprise, because after a series of very poor elections, most particularly the local and European elections in 2019, Sinn Féin went in to last year's election on the defensive. In the week before the election was called, Sinn Féin was still trimming its tickets. It was taking candidates off tickets because it was afraid that instead of challenging for two seats in constituencies, it was going to split the vote and end up with no seat in some constituencies, which is what gave you that underperformance relevant to its share of the vote in terms of the TDs that it returned. So, you know, while Sinn Féin fought a really good campaign last year, certainly, it hit that wave, and it demonstrated, I think, that Mary Lou MacDonald is a very formidable campaigner who generates a connection with people on the campaign trail. And that will be a factor in the next election whenever it comes. To some degree, Sinn Féin was lucky to hit that wave at the time. You know, not entirely by accident, certainly to some degree by design. But that having been said, it still caught the party somewhat by surprise, and demonstrates, I think, the truth of what we're saying is that as the electorate has de-aligned, more votes in the political marketplace are up for grabs, ergo the campaign matters more.
Theresa, I was looking back at the coverage of the election exactly a year ago as the results came in that week. And one of the recurring themes was that this had proved to be a change election, that people were looking for change. Now, there was some argument about whether they got that in the end with the government that we finally got. But what was the change that people were looking for? And who were the kind of the key parts of the electorate who were driving that desire for change?
I guess change was the kind of word of the moment. In terms of who moved their vote or who moved from one political party to another, we know that younger people drifted towards Sinn Féin in greater numbers than they had at previous elections. But there was actually a more substantial movement towards Sinn Féin. So the party has struggled usually amongst older voters, but in 2020, even amongst older voters, 65 plus, they were actually picking up more. So they were picking up across the whole demographic spectrum, but they were particularly doing well in the kind of 18 to 34 demographic. So we know younger people in particular, for Sinn Féin, younger people without third level education, but they do especially well. That's probably their strongest cohort, but they do well also with people with third level education. So I think age and social experience were very significant in moving a cohort of people away from the governing party, Fine Gael, and towards other political parties. Fianna Fáil, is for 10 years now, we've been talking about Fianna Fáil kind of stuck in this vice grip that it doesn't entirely know where it's going to position itself. Is it going to advance itself or continue as a kind of a localist conservative style political movement, which is clearly what kind of a cohort of the TDs want? And then there's the leadership that are kind of dragging the party, if you want, in a more social democratic and probably kind of socially pragmatic direction. And it's constantly getting squeezed in this space. It does well amongst older voters, but there's a kind of a horrible demographic reality about doing well amongst older voters, that there are fewer and fewer older voters. And it's not building its brand or connecting to younger voters. So when you look at the age profile of the people who voted for the party, it does really poorly amongst younger voters. And I think there's another thing to layer in here, and that I think there's the space between Fianna Fáil and Sinn Féin, is that Fianna Fáil used to do very well amongst urban working class voters. It really, and if we think particularly of the Bertie Ahern years, it did especially well in that demographic. And Sinn Féin has been putting it under enormous pressure in that space for a very long time, and it's been absorbing those voters. The question, as I said at the start, is whether this connection is enduring or whether it's temporary on the basis of a particular set of circumstances at any individual election. But there's no doubt that there are contours of a new kind of social base that's underpinning the voting patterns that we see. So we see Sinn Féin doing particularly well amongst DE voters and say Fine Gael doing particularly well amongst kind of the upper middle classes. We see an age effect with Fianna Fáil doing better with the older voters, particularly on the Western Seaboard, but Sinn Féin gobbling up in the younger age cohorts. So there are social dynamics that we can identify here and say that they underpin some of what is happening. So who want to change? Well, the people who were moving away from the traditional kind of two-party system towards these other parties in the system. Other beneficiaries, of course, at the election in 2020 were the Green Party. Which really surged in terms of its representation in Parliament. And I think the Social Democrats, I think the Greens were expected to do very well. You know, if we were here a year ago, before the election, we would have been expecting and anticipating the Green Party to do well. I think the Social Democrats also captured some of that that space somewhat more unexpectedly and grew significantly. And the Greens, the Labour Party and the Social Democrats, they're all swimming in the one pool. They're drawing their voters from very similar, well-educated cohorts of voters. So there's a common kind of social profile to the people who vote for those political parties, and to some extent, kind of minor issue differences or indeed candidate-based factors, and the fact that those parties don't run candidates in every constituency influence the kind of final outcome of how many gets elected from each of those.
And we might look in a moment about what that means for the emergence of more of a left-right divide along, you know, traditional lines that we're familiar with from other countries in Ireland. But I wanted to ask you, Jen, about that generational question, which I think is really interesting, that there clearly is, perhaps not surprisingly, huge dissatisfaction among the under-35s with the card which they've been dealt by the Irish state as it emerged out of the post-crash years of 2008 and 2009. And that's a huge problem. You know, if you're in any business, including running a political party, if you've lost the youngest cohort, that's not good for your future, prospects, is it?
No, not really. I mean, to a certain degree, this kind of debate about engaging young people in politics has been around for, you know, a long time. This isn't really anything particularly new, I don't think, you know, and I just think the context has changed. And I think that, you know, for all the reasons that we've already outlined in the shift away from the two-party system, the shift away from the party loyalty that we would have seen before, also that generational thing of, you know, who your father voted for, who your family voted for, if your family was a Fianna Fáil family, a Fine Gael family, et cetera, et cetera. A lot of that is kind of, you know, not really the way people vote now. And I think for younger voters, what we've seen, you know, issues that they have been engaged with, over the last few years, we can look towards maybe some of the referendums that we've had, same-sex marriage referendum, referendum to repeal the Eighth Amendment. And there was talk of those during those referendums that those issues would politicise kind of a younger generation. And then even that school of thought had its critics saying, no, these are specific issues and you're not going to see these younger people, maybe who are even flying home to vote, if you remember, necessarily engaging with the wider political system. I think really what happens is, you know, as you maybe move through your 20s, you know, into your 30s, you kind of take more of a stake, I suppose, in society. Maybe you need to, maybe you have a family, maybe you need to, you know, buy a home, maybe you can't get a home, maybe you've lost your job, you know, basically you've more responsibility. And I think the engagement between people in politics, I think it tends to increase in terms of the stake that you have in politics when you get a little bit older. And I think probably if we just look to the lessons of the last general election, the things that mattered to the younger voters, and we saw this broken down, as we mentioned there, in terms of the different parties and which voters voted for which issues. It was those issues of particularly housing and health. So I think the challenge is still there for parties to really figure out how they get those younger voters on board. And I think we're seeing some parties trying to I suppose capitalize on, like I mentioned earlier, on the social media and thinking, okay, these younger voters are primarily very tech savvy, you know, very much on all of the platforms, probably not buying a newspaper, potentially not a subscriber. How do you talk to these younger cohort people? And I think that's a question that's still very much unanswered, to be honest, because the idea of, you know, one party downloading a TikTok account and, you know, somehow garnering a huge amount of votes from that, I don't think it necessarily will wash, because, you know, like we said, the things that matter to those voters aren't the things that matter to the voters before. So I think, you know, if you look at what the parties are doing at the moment, Sinn Féin very much dominant across social media. And we've seen that in the last election. They were the party to be contended with. They were all over Facebook, Twitter, you name it. They were on it. And, you know, we saw all these kind of memes and stuff that captured sort of the imagination and creativity. And the other parties are going back to their base. Like Fine Gael is very much involved in going back to their constituencies at the moment. We've got Owen Murphy, I think, who is being tasked by Leo Varadkar with really going back and finding out what went wrong in each individual constituency. Fianna Fáil the same, but Fianna Fáil obviously just have got their feet back under the table, and for the first 100 days of government were really just trying to figure out the levers of power again. And in fact, their first 100 days of power were a complete calamity, I think it's fair to say. So yeah, I think that question of younger voters, very much an open question still. But if we take the lessons from the last election, that they are very much motivated by issues which affect them naturally, then I suppose that's where the parties will be looking next time to ensure they have either a better track record on, or some eye-catching promises or solutions, you know.
Pat, Georges Clemenceau said, I think, that a man who is not a socialist at 20 is a knave, but a man who is a socialist at 30 is a fool. But that was in 19th century France, when life expectancies were much shorter, and I think there was far lower take-up of third-level education, and, you know, deferred adulthood didn't work in the same way as it does these days. Jen's point about people not having a stake in society, I think, goes much higher up the demographics now, because people aren't able to, you know, buy a house, they get into their 30s, they're not able to settle down, get a family, they don't have security of tenure in their jobs in some cases. Is that perhaps one of the things that's contributing to what I think is pretty obviously something of a leftward shift in Irish politics?
There's no doubt. Yes, is the answer to your question. And there's no doubt that there has been a leftward shift in Irish politics. I think that is obviously clearly the case since this massive expansion of the state fueled by borrowing that we've seen during the pandemic. But actually, it was underway well before that. And I've written about it a couple of times, that, you know, the divide, I mean, you can describe it as an emerging left-right divide, and that's fine insofar as it goes. I think it's perhaps more accurately described as a divide between political moderates and political radicals. And for the first time, I think, you know, with Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael, Green government, as we have, all or most of the moderates are in the governing camp. One of the reasons why the question of coalition is so difficult, I think, or has been so difficult, and will probably become more difficult for the Green Party, is that divide between moderates and radicals, between those who favour slow and incremental change, sustaining many of the advances, or as many of the advances as possible, as Irish society has made over the last several decades, and those who favour, on the other side of the political divide, those who favour much sharper, much more dramatic, much more radical change. I think that line of division, that dividing line, goes kind of through the middle of the Green Party, which is one of the reasons why it is finding and will find coalition difficult. But I think, you know, those are, I mean, you can describe the division in different ways, but it is it certainly seems to me to be the emerging shape of Irish politics, with the radicals on one side and the moderates on the other. And I think for now at least, the momentum seems to me to be with the radicals. I think that could possibly shift, but certainly those on the radical side of that divide, Sinn Féin, many of the independents, People Before Profit, most of the Social Democrats, Labour by rhetoric, if not by by genuine political inclination or history, are all on that side, which favours much more radical change in Irish society. I think their election manifestos will, when the next election comes, will reflect that. And a good deal of how that is perceived is influenced by both generational and socioeconomic status, and those two are obviously related.
Therese, I'm very interested by this, just in terms of looking ahead for a moment, whether you characterise it, as Pat does, as, you know, radical and moderate, or whether you characterise it as left or right. I'm not sure that matters that much. But there is, for those on the left side of the ideological divide in Ireland, it seems more so than ever before, you know, the prospect tantalizingly within reach of essentially a left-wing majority in the next Dáil, should things go well, should Sinn Féin increase their seats by the amount they hope to, then along with a number of the smaller groupings, probably including the Green Party, taking on board what Pat says about them there. But I can't see the Green Party having a huge problem with things like Sinn Féin's housing policy, for example, putting together a governing coalition for the first time in the history of the Irish state. But that then raises the question of the other element of what constitutes current left-wing politics in Ireland, which is populism. And that's really where the divide is within the left, isn't it? On issues such as carbon tax, property tax, sorts of things which have sustained the smaller parties like PPP and Sinn Féin in opposition, but could cause all kinds of governing problems for them should they be looking to actually enter government.
Yeah, I suppose to start with, it's worth saying that we're closer to balance between left and right now than we've really ever been at any kind of point in history before. Our voting preferences in Ireland have tended towards the right, mostly to the centre right, with, you know, parties getting up to 80% of the vote on that side of the spectrum. And now with the kind of shifting balance in support, we're much closer to equality than we've ever been in the past. So we are in a genuinely different electoral environment to that which we've seen before. But one of the kind of defining features of the left for a long time in Ireland is still with us, and that is that it is very fragmented. And there are a lot of smaller political parties. And there are inherent dangers for a lot of those political parties at the next election. And, you know, if we look, dig into them in a little bit of detail, I mean, the far left parties, People Before Profit, Solidarity, Rise, I mean, they're basically on electoral life support from Sinn Féin. The only reason that most of their TDs are actually still there is because Sinn Féin didn't have second candidates or somebody else to transfer to in the constituencies where they got elected. So one of the things that we kind of have to be alert to is that there could be more consolidation of the left at the next election, and with a kind of a single larger party emerging at the core of the left, which will be essential for them if they're going to form a government. And that really, the momentum seems to be with Sinn Féin very clearly at the moment. But as Sinn Féin expands, you know, they become the anchor of the left. But they will also gobble up some of the kind of softer seats on the edges or on the periphery around them. And that could actually make it easier for them to go into government because they will have a stronger position. They will need to engage with fewer political parties. And I would kind of investigate some of the kind of positioning of these parties a little bit more on the left, because parties on the far left, you know, we talk about centre left and far left, and by its very nature, that kind of assumes that these parties are kind of close together and that they can easily come together in a government and overcome their policy differences. But oftentimes parties on the centre left have much more in common with those on the centre right than they do with their compatriots on the same side of the spectrum, because parties on the far left reject the very nature of market capitalism. You know, they don't agree with the overall system that we have, which is why going into government with parties from the far left would be quite difficult for Sinn Féin. So it could be it could actually ease the pathway to power if that cohort of representatives were to lose their seats, and it would make it a little bit easier for Sinn Féin. Sinn Féin, in relation to the populism thing, certainly benefit from a very strong anti-establishment populism that exists amongst Irish voters, which is kind of a hostility to the general political system, a belief that, you know, politicians are only in it for themselves. They only care about the rich and powerful. They're not interested in ordinary voters. So when we ask voters about these things, we find that the party that captures the largest cohort of populist voters is definitely Sinn Féin. Independents do well in that space as well. Does that necessarily make governing difficult? Well, across Europe, populist political parties have been getting into government, and they've been staying in government. They've had to temper their rhetoric somewhat, I suppose, in some parts, but not always. So populism itself is not necessarily an impediment to government. I think where the real interesting question lies is how you retain those voters once you are in government. And I think this is, for Sinn Féin, this is really where the interesting questions are at the moment. Sinn Féin's success means that, it now leads the opposition. It is becoming part of the political establishment. It's getting closer to governing. But there are real dangers in governing for Sinn Féin, because that governing penalty that has been so punitive for all the other political parties is coming right back at you once you get your first term in government. It's probably even more problematic more difficult for Sinn Féin, because they do have this strong support base that's so opposed to the system, and how you retain that connection to those voters once you become the system is very difficult. And then Sinn Féin, I think it has to be mentioned as well, has other growing pains. All parties experience growing pains and difficulties with candidates and people contesting at local level, but these are more protracted or more difficult for Sinn Féin, given the nature of the political party and its connections to the conflict, and problems of bullying are all very difficult within the party, more difficult than they are for other political parties. So there are lots of things that can trip them up here in terms of their expansion. But that being said, the momentum is with them right now. The one last caveat, though, I'd leave on all of that is we have to be a little bit careful about thinking about the kind of terrain on which the next election is going to be fought. There's no reason, banana skins, aside and all of that, to believe that there's an election coming anytime soon. And it's likely that the pandemic will kind of fade into the background. And then the political terrain that faces us for the next election is one of very high unemployment, protracted problems with economic recovery, paying for the significant costs of the pandemic. There are real problems ahead for the government once it begins to unwind the pandemic supports, because once you give money, it becomes near impossible to take it away without there being, significant pushback against that. And I think that's going to be the context for the next election. At the moment, we're kind of in a frozen moment in time, and the pandemic has kind of frozen everything. And it's very difficult to say where politics and looking at it right now, what's going to happen. I think we have to roll forward the kind of political fallout and economic fallout of the pandemic, and then kind of place where the parties are in that context and imagine where the kind of terrain for the next election would be.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it, Jen? I mean, one of the things that strikes me about that kind of sharpening divide is that one of the parties that might benefit most from that might be Fine Gael in the medium to long term. But listening back to a couple of the podcasts that we were doing in this week last year and some of the other coverage, it's a bit like watching the first half of Titanic, which is, as far as I remember, is about 14 hours long, in which not a lot happens, but people are kind of, falling in love and cheating on each other and running up and down stairs. And that's sort of the election.
Just like the podcast, yeah.
Yes, but little do they know that everything is going to change in the not too distant future. And in a way, looking back 12 months back now, that's what it looks like to me. But certain things got obscured because of what happened in March, almost, not much more than a month later. And among those things is the fact that Leo Varadkar ran a terrible election campaign and had a terrible result. And I'm still not sure that that's been entirely taken on board by Fine Gael.
Yeah, I would agree with you there. I think that it's quite evident that Fine Gael had a very, very bad day at the office. And I think, in the early stages of the campaign, when we had some of the first polls coming in, perhaps there was a false sense of security for Fine Gael. I definitely sense that even amongst people who talk in Fine Gael about what happened afterwards. When we were 2 weeks into the campaign and we had our first poll, I think, in the Irish Times, and it had Fianna Fáil at 25% and Fine Gael at 23% and Sinn Féin at 21%. Now, obviously, that was only week two. But, I think Sinn Féin at that stage were up 7 points and the momentum was clearly there behind them at that early stage. And on that day when we had that poll out, was a day when the unions came out very strongly in relation to the increase in the pension, the planned increase in the pension age. And still, I remember that week, Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil weren't properly saying what their plan was for afterwards, for, you know, if they got elected for that specific issue. And at the end of that week, it was only at the end of the week when we saw them scrambling to form kind of a coherent position on it. And I remember during going to the different campaign events, I think I was marking Fine Gael at the time, and they just doubled down on their message on the economy and Brexit. Instead of reacting and seeing kind of momentum, instead of thinking about perhaps changing tack, they just doubled down. And I think when they look back at what they did, I think that was a mistake, because clearly the message wasn't resonating with people. And, you know, instead of just continuing on and hoping that people would eventually get it, perhaps looking at what people were more engaged by or more enraged by, even. So I think in terms of the reviews, Fine Gael, to the best of my knowledge, have finished their review, and they found that the party, as I mentioned before, was detached, and they found that the economic reality, as they put it, what they saw as their crowning achievement, just wasn't being, it wasn't being recognised as they felt it by the voters, and they had to ask themselves why that was, and why people didn't necessarily care about Brexit. And then in terms of Fianna Fáil, I think our colleague Harry McGee had a piece the other day talking about how I think they've yet to even start their review. I mean, they're in a completely different context here. You know, they haven't even gotten under the skin of what happened, albeit that they came out technically on top, you know, with the largest amount of seats. So that's still a question mark. We still don't know. They certainly haven't gone into any great depths with that, obviously, beyond the normal chatter that you'd hear after any election.
Finally, Pat, as you know well, I really don't like to compliment you, but I did listen back to the podcast on the 11th of February 2020. And even though it was very unclear what was going to happen, you laid out pretty clearly that it was going to take several months, that lots of people wouldn't go into government, but that something would probably happen, that there wouldn't be a second election, almost certainly. And a lot of people were talking about a second election in the immediate aftermath of last February. And although you didn't say that there was going to be a Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael, Green coalition, you certainly didn't rule it out. And it was definitely a potential shape of things to come. So given all that, given that your proven crystal ball credentials there, listening to what's been said here today, among them the fact that there's a penalty attached to being in power, and the other being what Theresa said about the difficult choices facing this government in the second half of its term. Am I right in saying that Mary Lou MacDonald is odds on to be the next Taoiseach?
I think it would be difficult to find anybody in Leinster House who doesn't believe that Sinn Féin are going to be in power after the next election, whether that will be as the lead party in a coalition. Somewhat fanciful, I think, looking at the numbers and the history of division on the left, whether she might be leader of a majority left coalition. Just to go back to something that Theresa was talking about earlier on, not alone would it be difficult, I think, to imagine the People Before Profit, Solidarity, TDs in a government. I don't think they would want to be in a government. That's not what their model of politics is about at this phase in their development. They may have ambitions towards a majority, what they would call socialist government, but I don't think joining a government with all of the compromises that necessarily entails is something that they are seriously contemplating now, or would do after the next election on any imaginable landscape. And if you think that the radical left are not going to be brought into a coalition, and you know that party strengths reflect something like what we have at the moment, then Sinn Féin's route to government is with one of the bigger parties. One of the reasons I was making those predictions this time last year, Hugh, is that I think the mathematical fact was that you needed two of the three big, medium-sized to big parties to join together to form the basis of a coalition government. I didn't see that either Fianna Fáil or Fine Gael would or could at that stage form a coalition with Sinn Féin. In fact, I wasn't even sure that Sinn Féin really wanted that. But irrespective of Sinn Féin's wishes, it was clear to me that Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael wouldn't do that, which only left them with one option, which was to come together themselves as the basis for a coalition. As we know, that's what happened. Now, it is possible, of course, in an election which, let us constantly remind ourselves, probably won't take place for 4 or 5 years. And, you know, where Irish politics is going to be by the beginning of the summer, I find it difficult to predict with any confidence, not to mind where it's going to be in three or four years time. But notwithstanding that, I think that it's likely to be the case that two of the three bigger blocs will need to come together to form the basis of a coalition government after the next election. So is that going to be a repeat of the current government? Possible. Is it going to be Fianna Fáil and Sinn Féin? And I think that, as we've seen in the reporting that Jennifer and our colleague Cormac have been doing in recent days, that is something that Fianna Fáil is turning itself towards, imagining in a realistic way, in a manner that it wasn't this time last year. And I think that that unlocks that emerging debate in Fianna Fáil about the possibility of a coalition with Sinn Féin, which I think is likely to be reflected in a pre-election position that simply doesn't rule it out in the way that it was ruled out last year. I think that unlocks a route to government for Sinn Féin and another possible realignment in Irish politics, because, you know, going back again to where we were this time last year, where the only possible government was one, I think, grounded by Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael. If Fianna Fáil changes its mind on the possibility of a coalition with Sinn Féin, which it seems to me it is moving towards, then you have a political competition, you have viable alternative governments in a way that you didn't this time last year. So that seems to me is the big change that is possible in the future, though the caveats of the unpredictability of Irish politics and global politics over such a long period of time, I think, always have to be borne in mind.
Indeed, caveats galore, and quite right too. We'll leave it there. Thanks very much indeed to Teresa, to Pat, to Jennifer, and to our producer Suzanne Brennan and our engineer JJ Vernon. If you do want to get in touch with us, you can drop us a line at politicspodcast@irishtimes.com. We are always more than delighted to hear your thoughts. But until the next time, thanks very much indeed for listening.